Blog Talk Radio. Listening to the broadcast, we call it From the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern as it comes to us. These broadcasts will usually be only about 1/2 hour in duration and broadcast in the 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time slot. We may even throw in a music selection or two. The program is not on a talk radio format, and we do not take calls during this half hour. It's reserved only for Eastern stories, history, and news. Our hosts retell these great stories that are selected from our files. You may even call a story you would like to share in your own words. We can do this by sending us an MP3 file, and we will insert it into our broadcast. Now, we'll tell you more about how to do that toward the end of our show today. We will continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We really hope you like this new addition to the Eastern Airlines radio show. Now, let's see if we can play an Eastern commercial. Now let's tell a story or two. Let me give you a little background about this first story that appeared in the book The Best of Repartee, which is a collection of 30 years of stories in the REPA magazine. That's the Retired Eastern Pilots Association's magazine. And back in 1981, the convention that was held, they asked for a speaker to be at that convention, and they chose Paul Edward Garber. Now, Mr. Garber, or Dr. Garber, I'm sorry, it's doctor, and you can see why in just a minute, was born August 31st, 1899, and he passed on September 23rd, 1992. Dr. Garber was the first head of the National Air Museum of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Through his work and effort, the most complete collection of historical aircraft in the world was gathered and preserved. It contains the sole survivors of many interesting historical aircraft types. In 1946, President Harry S. Truman created the National Air Museum as a separate entity of the Smithsonian. Garber played a key role in the process and was assigned as a curator to the museum. The present National Air and Space Museum building opened in 1976. But most important, Garber, as first curator and devotee, helped to assemble the most impressive collection of historic aircraft in the world for the institution. Now, here's remarks made at the convention in 1981 by Dr. Garber. This particular day on a Sunday afternoon, it was, I hit one of those darn things. If I hadn't hit it, and if the lawnmower hadn't stopped, I would never have heard the telephone. I went over to pick it up, and somebody at the other end said, are you Paul Garber? I said, yes. Smithsonian? Yes, again. What are the 10 most famous airplanes of all times? I said, who the heck wants to know? He said, well, I thought you might know. You might have the answer. Oh, I said, I wouldn't have the answer. I don't know who would. I might have an opinion. This turned out to be Kevin Brown, the air expert for Hearst Enterprises magazines. He said he was calling long distance from Chicago, so with him paying for the call, I could take my time. I guess it was a half hour later, we did agree we should chop off the big lumps. We agreed that we would get rid of the military types, only have commercial or private, that we would eliminate, and we would eliminate foreign and limit it to airplanes. So with that, I agreed that the number one would be the Wright Flyers, the Wright Brothers Kitty Hawk Flyer, as it was called. He said, all right, what's number two? Well, several minutes later, I came up with another one, and so on, until I finally had 10 that I could justify. But then I said, what do you want this for? He said, I'm going to write a story for Hearst Enterprises magazines and call it the 10 most famous airplanes of all time, according to the Smithsonian. I said, you can't do that. I'm not the Smithsonian. I just work there. If you want a story like that, you want more than one opinion. You should have a panel. He said, well, who should be on the panel paying for it so I could take my time on that one? Well, I said, go to the top. Charles Lindbergh, who was alive then, Jimmy Doolittle, Jerry Hunsaker, who's the dean of aeronautics at MIT, Grover Loewing, the first graduate of an aeronautical engineering course in America, John Victory, who was the executive secretary of what is now NASA. While I was hunting for a sixth one, he asked if I would be number six, and I said, well, yes. But I said, you'll never get that bunch together. By Joe, he did. In anticipation, knowing that they were going to get together, I got together a list of about 100 aircraft in which I knew these 10 would be. I got specifications and photographs and performance records everything I could get together so they could make a good selection. And we met at the Statler Hotel in Washington. We were supposed to have lunch, but we were too busy to eat. I had a tape recorder, and I put it on the floor where nobody could see it because a tape recorder always slows you down. It started with my foot whenever I wanted it to go on. Later on, when I played it back, all you could hear was, "Hell no." The hell no was Jim Doolittle. But it was certainly the most enjoyable thing I've ever been through to be with these men. Those minds was such a problem. He could not get it down to 10, and they said that we could eliminate foreign because it was some foreign aircraft that had a worldwide relationship to progress. Well, I did have a criteria that I'd gone by, and I was asked today at the morning meeting what these criteria are, and I named one or two of them. They were technical advancement, historical achievement, significant use, impact, what effect it had on aviation, lasting value, innovation, public benefit, wide application, economic value, spectacular breakthrough, and personal relationship. With those in mind and adding foreign and including one helicopter, we got it down to 13. We just could not go any further than that. So my subject, famous aircraft. The first one is the Kitty Hawk Flyer, the Wright Brothers aircraft. The Wright Brothers became interested in flying when they heard about Lilienthal in Germany with his gliding. They wanted to know more about gliding and more about experiments in aeronautics, so they wrote to the Smithsonian. The letter was dated May 30th, 1899, and it began, "I have been interested in a problem of human and mechanical flight ever since I was a boy and made kites and model airplanes. I believe that human flight is possible to mankind. I wanted to go at it such time as I can spare for my business. I wish to avail myself of all that is already known, and then, if possible, add my little bit to help one of the future workers who will attain final success." Signed, Wilbur Wright. Well, I showed that one time to Orville Wright. He said, "Yes, I remember that letter." But he should have said we instead of I. So in writing to us at the Smithsonian, I say us. I wasn't quite born then. I'd come along in 2 months. But in writing to the Smithsonian, they knew that Professor Langley was our secretary, that is, our head of the institution. And he had been experimenting in aeronautics for a number of years. So because of his help, the Wright brothers learned about the progress in the past and about the current work being done by Octave Chanute in Chicago, James Means in Boston. They learned about what others were trying. They began with a box kite because they learned about the invention of the box kite by Lawrence Hargrave in Australia in 1893. They flew this kite with 4 strings and 2 sticks. And with the kite up there in the air and those 2 sticks with lines going out to the kite, they could do this and make it soar on its vertical axis and then make an X out of the sticks and thus balance it for roll. That was the world's first 3-axial controlled aircraft, that kite of 1899. They then built a series of gliders, 1900, 1901. But with the 1901 glider, they had difficulty in balance. They then went back to their home in Dayton, Ohio, and constructed a wind tunnel. With that, they made precise measurements of lift and drag, the effect of curved surfaces, various shapes and plan form, aspect ratio, and from those scientific experiments, developed their third glider in 1902. With that one, mankind first did embody 3-axial controlled in a craft he was riding in. Then they added power and control, developing a 12-horsepower engine and efficient propellers. The first test was made of it on December 14, 1903, with Wilbur at the controls. He won the toss of the coin. But in taking off, he pulled back too far and stalled and came down rather hard-breaking up some parts of the landing gear. 3 days later, it was repaired, and Orville had his turn, and he did take off and make a successful flight. In 1908, in the Century magazine of September, he described that flight. Our first flight was for only 12 seconds, a very modest flight compared to that of birds, but it was nevertheless the first time in the history of the world that a machine heavier than air and carrying a man had risen from the ground under its own power, had flown forward under control, and that without wreckage at a point equally as high as that from which it had risen. A beautiful definition of true flight. Every now and then they dig somebody out of the woodwork, and whether it's a Pierce in New Zealand or a Jethro in Germany or Ardale in France or of Maxim in England or Whitehead in Connecticut, they'll say he flew before the Wright brothers, but let them take that work and examine it in accordance with that definition. You'll find that if other persons might have hopped a bit or perhaps bumped a bit, in fact, one time a chap was arguing with me, I finally got him down to the point where I said, according to your belief, I think Adam was the first one to fly because he must have jumped a half an inch when he saw that snake. The Wright brothers were indeed the first. Another quotation is found on the base of the monument on top of Killdevil Hills, from whence they made their glides. And that reads, in commemoration of the conquest of the air by the brothers Wilbur and Orville Wright, conceived by genius and achieved by dauntless resolution and unconquerable faith, the Wright brothers were the first ever to attain three-axial control of an aircraft, the first ever to design a successful airplane, the first ever to build it, the first to fly it. They continued their experiments. Wilbur died in 1912 and Orville in 1948. But during that time, they and their associates developed 32 different aircraft. They also established four schools in which they taught others to fly. Nowhere else in the history of invention has a basic idea been carried so far as that of the airplane. Number two on my list was Louis Barot in France, the Blériot 11 airplane, the first ever to fly from one nation to another. The Daily Mail set up a prize of £1,000, then about $5,000 for the first flight across the English Channel. A number of pilots undertook that, but the first to succeed was Louis Blériot. He took off from the coast of France near Calais on the 25th of July. He started out over the water. He had no map, no compass. He just instead said, where's England? They said, it's over that away. About 35 minutes later, he saw the cliffs of Dover and made a rather bad landing. But that was the first nation-to-nation flight. His airplane was an innovation. It was a monoplane, just one wing, not two. Also, the propeller was in front, and then it had some bit of a cockpit, whereas the Wright brothers were just out in the open. In fact, the Wright brothers lay prone in 1903. So that was number two in the series. Number three, the Curtiss Hydro Aeroplane of 1911. Then Curtiss got into aviation because he could make a Glenn Curtiss. He could make a good engine. He made good motorcycles. The motorcycle engine was used by Tom Baldwin in his airship called the California Arrow, which won the St. Louis Exposition Airship Event in 1904. And then Alexander Graham Bell, who liked to fly kites, wanted to work on airplanes. He had a group of assistants that he named Glenn Curtis, and he named Glenn Curtis the engineer. And Curtis made an engine for them. In fact, Curtis had no dynamometers in a way of testing the engine, so he wrapped a motorcycle around this thing and took it with him to Florida. There he won an ordinary motorcycle event, but then asked permission to ride this in orbit motorcycle that he had with a 40-horsepower engine in it, the engine intended for an airplane. It took him about a mile to get started. Then he went through the measured mile, about 2 miles, to slow down. The speed was 136 miles per hour. No one had ever gone so fast before. So he made a copy of the engine because that first one was burned up, and that was used in Alexander Graham Bell's airplane, which were the Red Wing, the White Wing, and the June Bug, the Silver Dart. Then Curtis began on his own after that organization broke up. He was the first one ever to sell an airplane, and that was in 1910. He made a wonderful flight down the Hudson River from Albany to New York on May 29, 1910. He then flew over Lake Erie in August of 1910 and was working on a float job up at Hammondsport, New York, at Lake Tioga, which was his hometown and the home lake. But he continued his experiments. He then went south from Hammondsport during the wintertime, and the San Francisco, one of his airplanes flown by one of his pilots, was the first one ever to go from shore and land on a battleship, turned around, and fly back to shore. The origin of the aircraft carrier today. Then it was the San Diego. On the 26th of January, 1911, his seaplane did become the first in America to fly from the water and alight safely, not the first in the world. The first in the world was André Fabre in March of 1910. But whereas Fabre just made that one great development and then stopped, Curtis kept on. In 1912, he invented the flying boat. In 1914, a twin-engine flying boat intended to cross the Atlantic, but the war in Europe stopped that. Then he made, for America, the NC, which is Navy Curtis, and one of those was the first to cross the Atlantic in 1919. So Curtis has a very firm place with his developments of waterborne aircraft, and it was his hydro airplane of 1911 that was the third choice. Number four, the Hookers of Germany, Hookers F-13, which in the opinion of the panel was the first one to embody all the characteristics of a transport airplane. Also, technically, it was all metal, had a BMW engine in it, rather poor plumbing in it, but because I remember one caught fire, we had six of them in the airmail. But that did embody all the characteristics of the modern transport back in 1920. Number five, the Verville Racer. Alfred Verville wanted to be a pilot, but upon working for Glenn Curtis, Curtis recognized his engineering ability and persuaded Verville to become a designer. Verville had his own company. He made the first flying boat for the Navy's use at Great Lakes, and then in World War I became a designer with McCook Field, an Army base at Dayton, Ohio. There, Billy Mitchell came to him and said, "Verville, I want you to make tomorrow's airplane today. I don't want a bird cage." Back in the time, the airplanes had a lot of wires. In fact, they used to get a canary bird. If this canary bird got away, you left a wire off the airplane. So Verville did design a beautiful low-wing monoplane, a tractor with retractable landing gear, which was the winner of the 1924 Pulitzer Race, the World Speed Classic for airplanes at the time. Verville became a very successful designer. Number six on our list, the Spirit of St. Louis. It was not technically an advancement, nor was it historically a first. It was the 13th to cross the Atlantic, not the first. The first was the Navy's NC-4, as I told you. But the airplane Spirit of St. Louis had a marvelous impact on progress, because the flight, which was the first nonstop solo across the Atlantic, so aroused everyone in the capabilities of the airplane that from then on, commercial aviation received a great impetus. So the impact is the important thing for the Spirit of St. Louis. Lindbergh had learned to fly in a standard J-1 in 1922. Then he barnstormed for a year or so and then improved his flying with the Army. He was number two at Brooks Field, number one at Kelly Field, out of a group of more than 100, and he was the head of the 13th class. Barnstormed then for a while because the Army had no place for the pilots at that time, but then was flying the mail when he heard about the Raymond Ortig Prize. Raymond Ortig was a French owner of the Beaufort and Lafayette hotels in New York. And when the NC-4 made its flight for America, the Navy in 1919, Ortig thought that something should go to France. So he then instigated a prize for the first nonstop flight between New York and Paris. Either way, the state of the art then was not adequate to accomplish it. But as progress went on, in 1926, there was an attempt which was not successful. In 1927, Lindbergh did take off May 20th from Roosevelt Field and did fly to Paris nonstop solo in 33 and a half hours for 3,600 miles. Lindbergh was one of the great persons of all aviation. He was a very dear friend of mine, a very fine gentleman, a good husband, a wonderful father, and a magnificent pilot and engineer. Now, number seven on our list, the Piper J3 Cub. The Piper J3 Cub. Jimmy Doolittle said that that's the airplane that brought aviation down to earth. It was developed in 1931 by Gilbert Taylor and then taken over in 1936 by Papa Piper, W.J. Piper. There were thousands of them made. In fact, in 1936, there were about half of our complete production of airplanes was a J-3 Cub. Following that was a DC-3, 344 of those made. And the DC-3 was the first airplane ever to pay its way economically as a passenger carrier and as a cargo carrier. It was developed by Donnell Douglas and his associates out in California. First used by American Airlines and then employed by a number of airlines and then throughout the world. The J-3, most widely used and widespread airplane ever of its time. I remember when Captain Eddie Rickenbacker came to Washington in a new Connie. I went to see him then and to see the Connie and to see Captain Eddie. I said, "Captain Eddie, you're giving up DC-3s?" He said, "Yep." Well, I said, "I'd like to have one for the museum." "All right. Will you pick me out a good one? One that has a real interesting history?" "Yep." And I went back to my office, and there was a letter from American Airlines saying, "We were the first to use the DC-3." I went back to see Captain Eddie. "Captain Eddie, I won't need to get a DC-3 from you. American Airlines has one for us. "The hell you say. So go to the museum now. and Fly Eastern's biggest advertisement they have for miles and miles around, Captain Eddie was the one who gave it to us. After the DC-3 came the XR-4, a helicopter developed by Sikorsky. Helicopters go back to Breguet in 1907, Cornu in 1907, and Bernard in 1922. A number of experimenters. The first success was by Heinrich Falk in Germany just before World War II began. But then in America, Sikorsky was experimenting, and his VS-300 was the first one to be practical in this country, and soon it quite surpassed the Falk. The XR-4 was the first helicopter ever to make a cross-country flight. That was from Stratford, Connecticut, to Dayton, Ohio, and outside of Dayton, he was met by an escort in an automobile with a big yellow patch on the top. The automobile stopped for a traffic light, and so did the helicopter. We have that also in the museum. In fact, we have 8 of these aircraft in our collection. Then the next one on the list came the X-1, the world's first supersonic aircraft. Back then, in 1947, There was a term, the sonic barrier, meaning nothing could get through with a speed less than that of the speed of sound. The speed of sound is 760 miles per hour at sea level at a temperature of about 70 degrees. It varies with altitude. So it seemed that nothing could go through the sonic barrier. America decided to get through that. Bell obtained a contract from the Air Force. The National Advisory Committee of Aeronautics was of assistance to them. The aircraft was completed on October 14, 1947. Charles Yeager flew it through the sonic barrier. He went on to a terminal velocity of about 1,000 miles per hour. Whereas in the first flights, the aircraft was carried aloft by a B-29 and then dropped away and then was given the power to fly on through the sonic barrier. But there was one time when he took off from the ground on his wheels and flew to about 22,000 feet. After the X-1 came the de Havilland Comet. Geoffrey de Havilland in England after World War II realized something should be done to make some substantial, rather dynamic progress. He, with his assistant, designed the world's first jet engine transport, 1949, and this did have a very good service between Britain and all parts of the empire and to many parts of the world. But there were 2 fatal accidents with 2 of them. And yet, from the efforts to learn what caused those accidents, men learned far more about how to design a successful transport. They were first powered with the Ghost engines of 5,000-pound thrust and then the Avalon engines of 10,000 pounds, a very good airplane for its time. Number 12, the Boeing 707. A great advance over the Comet and about twice as efficient, developed by Allen and the assistants out there at Boeing and still in use. In fact, Air Force One, our president's airplane, is a 707, and the type dates from 1954. Number 13, the X-15. And I can best make you acquainted with that by comparing the X-15, which is number 1 of our series of the world's greatest aircraft. I can compare the X-15 with the Wright Brothers Flyer, For the Wright Brothers Flyer, a right hand, the X-15 over here. Wright first, let's talk about the Wright first, Flyer first, then the X-15 statistic. On the left is the Wright Flyer, 31 miles per hour. On the right, the X-15, 4,534 miles per hour. Altitude for the Wright Flyer, about 20 feet. Altitude for the X-15, 354,200, which is 67 miles high. The weight, the Wright Brothers aircraft, 750 pounds with pilot. The X-15, 56,000 pounds ready for takeoff, fully loaded. The horsepower, the Wright Flyer, 12. And the X-15, about 57,000 pounds of thrust with a Navy engine, incidentally. Fuel, a half gallon of gasoline for the Flyer. For the X-15, 1,003 gallons of liquid oxygen and 1,445 gallons of anhydrous ammonia. Cost $850 for the Flyer, including the round-trip ticket from Dayton to Kitty Hawk and back again, about a third of a billion, and worth every penny for the X-15 because all we've learned from that aircraft for both air and space. Persons, two, Wilbur and Orville. Honorable mention for Charlie Taylor, who was their mechanic in their bicycle shop, who helped on the engine, about 10,000, developing the X-15 in all phases of its progress. About 10,000 people developing that aircraft. The instruments, the Flyer only had three. A little pinwheel, told you how much air that went through a stopwatch, and a counter that pushed into the center of the engine shaft and told you how many RPMs was being developed. Each was controlled by a stick. The stick was pulled by a string fastened to the launching track. The stick brought it back to one side and then stopped the three instruments. And in the X-15, more than 200 instruments in the X-15, including the telemeter and devices back to Earth. Dimensions, much more span than length. 40 feet, 4 inches for the Flyer versus 20 feet, 1 inch per length. 50 feet, 9 inches in length, and 22.5 feet, 4 inches in span. Takeoff with a little front rudder, roller, which was a bicycle hub on a cross strut, and a roller skate at the back on a piece of 2x4 underneath the skids, just about the center of gravity on a long rail, because wheels wouldn't roll in the soil, soft sand down there in Kitty Hawk. On the X-15, takeoff was from a B-52 at 45,000 feet. Landing, remember that front roller and two skids? Landing on a front roller and two skids, we haven't learned a thing about setting them down since 1903, except we have the world's finest airplanes in our transport system. We have the world's finest airlines with Eastern Airlines at the top. We have wonderful personnel and general aviation airplanes. Personal and general aviation airplanes, more than any other nation, about 150,000 of these. We have the finest scientific developments in NACA, in the many laboratories of our nation and the various companies. We have the SR-71, which can cross the Atlantic in about 1 hour. We have the U-2 that made the first foreign high observations of the Russians. We have the 747. We have the B-1 bomber. And thank goodness they're going to make it. It's astounding to see how far we have come from 1903 until today, because the X-15 is still very valuable. Had it not been from what we've learned, bring the X-15 down from altitude, the efforts with the shuttle spacecraft of today could never have been successful. Truly a wonderful progress. It's been my privilege to see. Another great privilege has been telling you about it. Thank you again to the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. And that is all we have for today. It went a little bit longer than I anticipated. However, it was a very interesting story or speech that was made at the Retired Eastern Pilots Convention in 1981. Keep that in mind, because there were still some legends in aviation still alive. So now that brings us to the end of our show, and we hope you have enjoyed these great Eastern stories, our stories selected from the Eastern files for today's broadcast. And remember earlier I said, why don't you do a story and record it and send it to us, and we'd be happy to play it here. If you'd like to do that and contribute that story from your Eastern days, and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, please give me a call or an email, at least an email. We'll start it off, and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story on this broadcast from the Eastern Files. Send your request to host@EALRadioshow.com. That's host@EALRadioshow.com. Just tell us that, hey, you think that you might have something that you might think would be of interest to our Eastern family, and we'll certainly put it out there. We want you to be part of the radio show. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. The time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you.
then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone, about the times I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. To go.
And don't forget, this Monday, October 3rd, our show at 7 p.m. is an interview with Captain Robert Wilbur. And I think you'll really enjoy it. He is our Hall of Fame recipient. When we had our convention, our reunion in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, this past week. And we want you to listen to that interview because you'll hear things that you've not seen in print. So we look forward to having you join us at 7 p.m. on the EAL radio show. Have a good day.